You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. From Darwin, Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sambeek. Thanks for joining me on Talk the Walk. This week I'm joined by Anthony Kelly, or Tony as I've come to know him. Tony has been instrumental in the tradition of the development of community development practices in Queensland since the 1970s, alongside people like Les Helliwell, Sandra Sewell, and Dave Andrews. In 1988, Tony published With Head, Heart and Hand, Dimensions of Community Building with Sandra Sewell. Tony has worked extensively for over 40 years as a consultant to government, corporations and NGOs in ways of working with communities. His approach to dialogue-based community work has taken him overseas to work with mining companies, as well as contributed to the work of Oxfam Australia back home amongst our Indigenous communities. I met Tony in 2005, when he was in his final year of lecturing at the University of Queensland after 25 years as a senior lecturer. I feel great privilege to have taken his final class that year. Welcome to Talk the Walk, Tony.
Thank you, Lucy, for having me.
I can honestly say, Tony, that taking your course in working with Indigenous communities pretty much changed my life. From little things, big things grow became my mantra. I often talk to people about that period being the time when the flame was sparked in me. I don't know if you remember me talking about that, but I knew from the moment I met you that this was the work I would end up doing, and of course, I ended up moving to the Northern Territory to pursue it. I'm not sure if you remember little old me sitting in your classes, do you, Tony?
I remember it very well, Lucy.
I'm not sure if you're aware, and I'm a bit ashamed to admit it, but the only reason I took your course was because other students were talking about how you'd cried in lectures, and I really wanted to see what all the fuss was about. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. But
I never actually did see you cry, but I assume it happened.
All right.
So you are obviously very passionate about this subject, and I'm wondering, where does this passion come from?
Oh, well, it's hard to say, Lucy, but I think a lot of it comes from my family. I had a mother and father who adored one another, besotted with one another. And I think, you know, in such a loving family, emotions were, you know, very, very real and open. So my elder brother is even more emotional than I am, so possible. So I think it that capacity to feel for others, I think, really stems right back from the earliest days of my childhood.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be teaching the subject, working with Indigenous communities at University of Queensland?
Well, when I finished my master's degree, I was invited to go to the Northern Territory to establish an Aboriginal community worker program. And it was in the days immediately after land rights had been given, and all sorts of issues were being put on the table about how the governance structures of local communities would be put in place, what governance structures would be put in place. So it was an amazingly important time and a great opportunity. So I moved from Brisbane to Darwin, but worked all over the Northern Territory, helping to establish this community worker program. So that was my first time working full time with Aboriginal people. Prior to that, I just worked on particular projects. So that was a tremendous learning time and wonderful part of my life. So that lasted for about, you know, 2.5 years. And from there, I returned back to Brisbane and joined the Department of Social Work at University of Queensland.
Sorry, Tony, I didn't quite catch. How many years were you working up here in the NT?
About 2.5 years.
Oh, right. And so that was the first time that the Department of Community Development was established here in the NT, or was it already established?
It was a time of great change, really, because the Northern Territory government was given independence, or the independence that it has been given from the Commonwealth. So it was during all those times as well where the Northern Territory government was establishing itself. So yes, there were welfare departments that were sort of quasi-Commonwealth departments prior to that. And when the Northern Territory government established full control over its own agenda, they did establish a Department of Community Development. And it was made up of it was a sort of super department in those days. It's made up of the Department of Local Government, the Department of Welfare, prisons was also part of it, so on. So it was a super department, in effect, that they called the Department of Community Development.
Right. So what was that like, landing in the Northern Territory, pretty green, not having worked here before?
Well, it was pretty challenging because a lot of those communities I'd never been to before, you know, Remanginning and Yuendamu, you know, on and on and on. So to visit them and to consult with them about who would be an appropriate local worker to appoint was a fantastic time, but very, very challenging, as you can imagine.
So we will talk about those challenges later, but I'm interested in what is it that you brought to the process when you first encountered those communities? What was your approach?
Well, I think you need to be, you know, very humble, of course, because you simply don't know, and you don't know what even you don't know. So that's even worse. I can remember one particular episode where one of the elders said to me, you know, where are you from? Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm from Darwin. And he said, well, are you born Darwin? And I said, no. And he said, well, where are you from? And I said, Brisbane. And he said, are you born Brisbane? And I said, no. And he said, oh, I'm not going to talk to you. You don't know. You don't know where you're from. And then he said, and what colour's that? And I said, green. He said, and what colour's that? I said, green. And he said, well, they're not the same colour. You don't know anything. I'm not going to talk to you until you tell me a story. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful interchange, one that I'll never, ever forget.
So what were your learnings in that conversation? What did you take away from that?
I think something that I knew as a development worker that it wasn't what I think should be done, or that whatever progress was to be made needed to be built on what they thought was their best way of going forward. I had to earn the right to hear that story and to be part of it.
And I imagine that's what played out next. He was telling stories. You gained enough trust for that to happen?
Oh, yes. He was a marvellous old man. So, yeah, that was in Galinku. So, yeah, very, very important community.
So for those social workers that aren't familiar with your approach to community development, how does it work? What are the principles behind it?
Well, the principles behind it really are that you've got to, first of all, hear exactly what the people are saying and doing, observe what they're doing. And that's what has come to be known as text. And that those words that they say and the things that they do are the information components that you need to respect and understand and listen to and respond to. And not to confuse that in any way with your interpretations of what's going on, because our minds fill up, you know, this is good, this is bad, this is different, I'm scared, this is whatever. So these are all our thoughts. And not to confuse them with the reality of with what we're dealing with. And this is the very basis of the dialogue, that we respond to what we call as text, which is what people say and what people do. So, you know, that understanding of that for me has sort of grown over many, many years, really. And it's the foundation of the work. You know, otherwise you move into rescue mode, into service mode, then, you know, has got a role, but it's not a development role.
So it sounds quite technical. Are you able to explain the technicalities behind the dialogue that you talk about?
Yes, there's levels and levels to it. First of all is the level within yourself. You've got to know who you are and what you believe and what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. So that level of the work, I think, is really very, very important. It enables us to reflect on what our contribution is and what our limitations are. And then the second level up is the process that I was talking to you before about, which is listening very, very carefully to the people and observing very carefully about what they do. So that's the text, which forms the, you know, the action component of the work. And buried in what people say to you are key words that indicate what it is that they think can be done. And to be able to hear those and action those is very, very important. And once you've got a hold of those key important words, then to start visiting other people in the community and sort of saying, is this important? Is it not important? Is it worth getting together to discuss this and do something about it? So it's a very methodical process. It's very careful. Sometimes it can happen quite quickly. Other times it's very slow. So it depends. I think the mythology is that it's always very slow. Sometimes it can happen very quickly. You know, people decide that they'll do it. The other myth about the groups is that they should last a long time. We've got a false view of that. You know, the little group in the community or within the family might only last a week or so in that form, but it can make its own contribution. It doesn't have to be sort of built in stone that lasts for 65 years for it to be important. It can be just a little meeting that makes things better. So we get bailed up sometimes by wanting monuments of, or I call them monuments of organisations that sort of are meant to last forever. Nothing lasts forever. So that frees you up to do little and big things and to let them be for as little or as long a time as can be.
Right.
So that's really at the community level the sort of steps that I think people really need to think about.
It sounds like it's quite a hopeful approach, grounded in autonomy and self-determination, that communities are really empowered to make decisions. Am I right?
Yes, you are right. And it's little as well as big. For example, when I was giving the introduction about what I did in the Northern Territory, perhaps the least successful component of it was the local government structures that we actually set up. The most important component of it was the dialogue that we had with individual people, you know, like Johnny McCumber, who went on to set up, you know, the TV and radio in Alice Springs, or Trevor Satour, who set up the Centre for Aboriginal Studies at Curtin in Western Australia. So the impact of the program, really probably the least important component of it, was its institutional building component. The most important component by far was the people, individual and people building component of it.
Yeah, right. So these wonderful initiatives grew out of the very small dialogues that you had with individuals and communities.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the stories that go on years and years and years after those dialogues, you know, I certainly don't want to claim any credit for their incredible contributions, but I think if you spoke to them, they would say the beginning journey was in those dialogues, like yours was in the classroom there.
Yeah, we can be so overwhelmed by the issues, the enormity of slow progress up here in the NT, and it's really hard to keep a focus on the small things, the little projects getting up, those small successes. We can get overwhelmed by the media talking about the gap being widened, not being closed, those kinds of things. So it's really a skill to focus on the small stuff. But like you say, from little things, big things grow.
Yes, absolutely. And the little thing, like, you know, having a child attend school for a couple of weeks and be welcomed and so on, who knows what that will bring, you know? So it's celebrating those small things among ourselves and with the community itself, without being a Pollyanna. I think it's really a central contribution of development work.
So can you speak about the values that might be behind this approach? And why would that be important for social workers out there in the field?
Well, I think the most important value that distinguishes it from service delivery is that the development approach places the emphasis on the community, on the person in the community, not on the service deliverer. So it's about what they do, and it's about what they think, and it's about what they want. Mm-hmm. And you are a secondary player in that process. You're of secondary importance. Whereas I've always had the feeling with service delivery, when you're doing things for people, that is reversed. The control of the process is reversed. And I think that's the biggest and most important difference. It's much, much, much more than consulting people. You know, the government feels quite happy with itself because we've consulted with you. That doesn't change the power arrangement. And this is why participatory development programs are so important. And yet, in Australia, we've really got such a poor record of them, a very poor record, because it's all bundled up into service modalities, not into people development modalities. And that's been my single most frustrating encounters with governments everywhere. They'll buy into it for a while and then suddenly, you know, they'll want to move away from it, go back to number crunching in service delivery and whether the gap's getting bigger or smaller or whatever. You know, they're very objectified measurements. They don't take into account the feelings and the thoughts and the hopes and the fears of people, which are participatory program deals with.
So for social workers that are listening to this, and this might be their first foray into dialogical development work, what might be a small step towards a different kind of approach that they might take on, taking these ideas into their work? Where might they start?
Oh, I think you can start anywhere. You can start with your partner sometimes. Helen's sitting next to me laughing at me because it's a lifetime struggle to actually listen and be with rather than do for or whatever. So I think, you start wherever, whenever you can, with whoever you can, whoever you know. It could be a friend, it could be a partner, it could be children, it could be a piece of work if you're formally employed, a piece of work that you think might go better in this way rather than in a service way. My advice is you start immediately and with whoever you can.
Sounds like good advice. Start at home.
Start at home, yeah. Start with a neighbour. Start with a piece of work that you think might be amenable to this. Start. And I don't know whether you can remember, Lucy, I don't know whether you did the community development course with me too, did you?
Not with you, with Ingrid Burkett.
Well, one of the tasks I always set was, begin talking with a neighbour, somebody who lives close by, just begin. And once you've begun, then the journey has begun. So that's what I think about it.
One of the things that stood out to me about doing the course with you was how it differed to other community development approaches. Can you speak to that? How is this way of working different to other community development approaches? And how might that inform our work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities?
Well, it's centrally based on, dialogue issues where you really, alongside and with people. Whereas there are other traditions of the work that are much more focused on the gaining of power and power differentials. So organising people to, demand rights and, demand changes to their circumstances and so on. So instead of it being based on dialogue, it's based on, concepts of power and structural inequality and overcoming that. So it's much more structural than personal. It's much more power-based than dialogical. And one of my very, very, very dear colleagues, we've known each other since we were young lads at university together. He's based his entire community development professional career on power and inequalities of structure. And he's loved by people from Papua New Guinea, Fiji, India, done a lot of work with the Aboriginal communities around Australia. He's a much loved figure. He's fearless. He's absolutely fearless. If you're in there for a fight, I'll be there with you. So he's much loved. A very, very different approach than the one that I've tried to enact and taught.
And let's go back to the challenges that you spoke about earlier. What have been some of the most difficult struggles or challenges you've faced?
Well, you know, when I talk about Indigenous communities, particularly the Australian Indigenous communities, the thing that I struggled with most of all was the violence of racism. It frightened me. I hated it. I couldn't believe the injustice of it, to experience it firsthand and so on. It was a shock, and it was great difficulty to me. And I've always struggled with that. It's something that I have to take a deep breath to deal with. But I think later in my career, an even more grave problem from my perspective was the black on white racism that I dealt with in some organisations. I struggled entirely, as I said, with the terrible white on black racism, but I struggled even more when it was black on white racism. I really struggled with that.
Can you give an example of what that might look like?
Well, there was a young, pretty inexperienced young woman, white, who was making mistakes, but quite clearly her heart and her young energy was a gift that she was trying to give. And she was hurt very badly by some senior Aboriginal people in the organisation. She was hurt very, very badly. So that was difficult. And also the black on black racism that popped its head out in the same program. And those two forms of racism I found in some ways more difficult. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I did. So yeah, they were real issues.
And what effect did that have on you as a practitioner or as a fellow human being?
Well, the immediate response was that I took it to the most senior levels of the organisation to be addressed. And it turned out that they were quite cowardly about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So it had a big impact on me. Helen tells me that I've never been properly debriefed because of it. But, these are very, very important, difficult episodes that I think we should be able to talk about, especially if we're very clear that we're not just sounding off, that we want to be part of a helpful process, part of building progress and helping each other, not just scoring points and all that, which is a disgusting aspect of it.
Right. So, what kinds of knowledges or skills do you think that you took away from those experiences that have complemented or added to your work or the way you see the world?
I think it made me grow up a little bit more, even though I'd been in the work for many, many years. It made sort of say righteousness is, doesn't belong to us and doesn't belong all to one party, and I think that helped me a lot in the international work that I did more of in the last years of my career, when Indigenous people were so cruelly done by, they're so cruelly done by everywhere, but on the odd occasion they're not always right. And to be able to be old enough and grey enough in the hair to be able to say, on that count, can we do it a bit differently, or should we be doing it a bit differently, or I don't want to support you on that. And they were big things for me as a white male, trying to help peoples that weren't of my culture, and I was a visitor and a stranger and a guest and all that.
And can you speak a bit more about, I guess, the learnings of that time here in the Northern Territory and how that influenced your work globally?
I think it made me very, very comfortable to be with Indigenous peoples. I mean, and I think the biggest contribution that the mob in the Northern Territory made to me, and there's plenty of stories that I can tell you about that, is just the love of being there with them in villages and hearing their stories and so on. I mean, that privilege of that has, and the wonderment of it has never ceased to amaze me. I can remember just in more recent years, one of the most memorable things for me was I was trying to help a mining company work better with Indigenous peoples, and there was an elderly lady, single, her husband had died some years before, who was the most important property owner in the area. And the company was full of worries about her, how she would react and what her concerns were, and so on and so forth. And to sit down with her and hear her story, she had seven children, who, five of whom were doing very, very well. She was not interested in money or compensation or the big mine. What her principal concern was that she had two sons, both in their 60s, who were intellectually handicapped, and she wanted to know how they were going to be looked after when she died. So all the hoodie-doo around, what her concerns were and the value of a property and da-di-da-di-da-di-da. When you sat down with her on the ground, listening to her, that was what she was concerned about. And that's an enormous privilege to be, allowed into people's hearts and homes and thoughts and aspirations like that.
That's interesting. So often we get into conversations and have expectations about what they are going to talk to us about, but the littlest things could be what they are actually concerned about, rather than what you think might be more difficult issues to resolve. Can you tell us a few more stories? I'd love to know about some of the sparkling moments. What was something you're really proud of, or some achievement, or good news story? I'm sure there are many.
One of the funny stories I think that I love to tell was the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory on my very last day as a worker in the Northern Territory government, wrote me a memo saying that my staff, the Aboriginal staff, had killed and eaten the pet kangaroo of the Navy, that they had jumped over the fence and, you know, ate this kangaroo up for good tucker. So I went down to my staff, who were under one of the trees in Smith Street at the time, sat down with them and said, you know, is it true that you've killed and eaten the pet kangaroo of the Navy? And they said, yeah, we did. Good tucker, good tucker. And I said, what are we going to do about this? And they said, we tell you this. You go tell your boss. He was suddenly my boss, not their boss. You go tell your boss that we did kill and eat the kangaroo, but the Navy were a problem because they made that kangaroo stupid and it wouldn't run away. And we'll replace that kangaroo with a proper one, an intelligent one that'll run away. So my last memo to the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory before I went off to the University of Queensland was to write that memo, that my staff would replace the pet kangaroo with an intelligent one that would run away. Very grateful to get out of the department at the time. So sparkling moments like that, where it was just a delight to be with them, really, the sense of humour and, you know, the sense of ground beneath us, you know, facing a silly little issue like that. But there were lots of other ones as well.
And a sense of humour. Did you find that important in the work?
Oh, absolutely. you definitely needed it. Especially when you made silly mistakes, you know, you really needed to be able to laugh at yourself a bit.
So how did you know when you made a mistake? Did it get pointed out to you, and how?
Sometimes it did. Sometimes it was pointed out to me. Sometimes there was just stony silence. not of the usual kind, but of a... So, yeah, you'd sort of have to go away and reflect that was probably not a good idea.
So silence was one of the communication methods being used.
Indigenous people specialise in it, really.
Yeah. Can you speak to some of the other communication tools that were important in your toolbox?
I think it's, flexibility really is the key thing. As you get sort of more and more experience, you're more confident in the sense of, you know your strengths and limits. You can make the work move a lot more quickly. You can see traps coming ahead and avoid them a bit. But the communication processes are very basic. You know, you need to watch very carefully what people are doing and listen very carefully to what people are saying and respond to that. That's the key. The key to it all is the accuracy with regard to that. And the old saying, you know, we've got two eyes, two ears and one nose and only one mouth. So there's a proportion of 5 to 1 in terms of what you should say or do.
So I'd just like to reflect again how we started this conversation. I remember you saying that family and growing up in a family where emotions were very real and open. Would you say this has been influential in the kind of work that you found yourself in and how your career developed over the years? Or were there other turning points in your life where you started heading in that direction?
Oh, yes, there were a number of those. For example, when I did my master's course, I did it under the tutelage of a very, very great Indian, Gandhian figure, a man called Saugata Dasgupta. He was taught by Gandhi, so he had direct contact with that tradition. And really until he died, he was an important senior mentor of mine. You know, by that stage, I'd been working for 15 years or more in the field, so I wasn't an inexperienced worker. But he gave me an international perspective on the work. You know, he opened, you know, me right out to, you know, to other places and other processes of work in other parts of the world. So he was a very, very important influence. But then people like Lilla Watson were working at the university. Bruce Alcorn, who invited me to go to the Northern Territory to set up that Aboriginal program. Ernie Stringer and Rosalie Dwyer from Western Australia were, you know, they're incredible couple who spent 10 years or more out in the Western Deserts right at the end of their career. They're my age, and right at the end of their career, they love to go out and spend time. So they spent 10 years in Warburton. They've been an inspiration. Daryl Pickett, Carol Martin, John Dagg, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of people that you can look back on and sort of say, you know, they supported and encouraged and taught and cajoled and corrected and all sorts of things. And not last but not least, somebody like Matt Foley, who, you know, became a well-known politician here in Queensland, but he taught at in the social work department. So lots and lots of people like that you know, have been, yeah, they become your brothers and sisters in the whole enterprise. Whether you succeed or fail, they're there with you.
So what have been some of your favourite resources or books sitting on your shelf that are a bit like a Bible for you?
You know, I'm speaking now as a white, non-Indigenous man. I think the work of Frantz Fanon is the most important piece of writing. I don't know whether you remember that framework that I shared with you, Lucy, all those years ago. You know, when people, Indigenous people speak, they speak not just of the history of the moment, but the history of the past and the future as well. So tradition, invasion, war, violence, poverty, welfare, new organisation, you know, that I don't know whether you can recall that framework, a really, really important framework. All of those moments of historical times and come out in the text of how people talk to you, you know. They talk about the good times in the past, the love of the land, and the next moment they're in a line wanting a food handout, you know. Go from the glory of tradition into a poverty cycle and then back into an anger cycle that, you know, they've been treated so unjustly, and then into a meeting where they're trying to establish a new program. So the text and the behaviour that they're using is a tumble of all this. Mm-hmm. And if you've not understood and immersed yourself in Fanon, I think it's hard to understand that. It's hard comprehend it and deal with it.
So the name of his book is?
The Wretched of the Earth.
Right. And what year was that?
He wrote that in the 1950s.
Yeah, well, we'll put all that in the show notes at the end, as well as some of the other resources that you've talked about.
Yeah, Lilla Watson, to go back to mentioning her again, she was the one that said, Tony, you must read Fanon.
All right. Well, I'm aware that time is getting away. Just in finishing up, are there any last words that you'd like to share with social workers that might be listening?
Look after each other, basically. It's a journey of you. It's a journey of the people. It's a journey of the community. It's a journey of each state. It's a journey of our country. And it's a journey of Indigenous peoples around the world. If you ever have the privilege of working with Indigenous peoples in other parts of the world, you know, it's remarkably similar, the struggle. Sometimes they've got more resources, sometimes they've got less, but the struggles are remarkably similar.
And it is a great privilege to be working in that space.
Yeah, look after each other and see it as a life's journey. That's the only way I was able to survive it and enjoy it and do it.
Thank you. I'm aware that you're at the end of your career now. You've retired, is that right?
Yeah, I've been retired now for about 3 years, Lucy. I do very occasionally do piece of work, mainly reflective work like this.
Yeah, beautiful. I appreciate so much for the time you've taken to dialogue with us today, Tony.
No worries, Lucy.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.